It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a lot of in-person therapy sessions are now happening online because of the coronavirus pandemic. Two Wisconsin therapists joined the show to tell us how it's working out. First, Wisconsin is one of a handful of states that are considered swing states in the upcoming November presidential election. The state is a mixed political bag. For the most part, there's the strong Democratic presence in cities like Milwaukee and Madison, and a concentration of counties in the metropolitan Milwaukee area have been Republican strongholds for decades. The WOW counties, as they're called, including Waukesha, Ozaukee, and Washington counties, have been reliably Republican for years. But in 2016, the strong Republican margin narrowed some in the election that delivered President Trump to the White House. Now, political watchers are eyeing the WOW counties as a potential Republican bellwether as President Trump seeks re-election. Craig Gilbert is Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Craig, welcome back to the show.
Hey, it's great to be with you.
Well, before we get into some of the more recent changes, Craig, talk about the WOW counties, these three counties that were a key part of Republican strategies to boost turnout and deliver votes.
Yeah, I've been covering Wisconsin politics for a long time, and one of the most predictable and reliable patterns you could find in Wisconsin elections was these very reliable Republican landslides in the WOW counties. I mean, these were suburban and exurban communities that always turned out at staggering rates, almost always generating big Republican landslides. They seemed to get more Republican every year for a long time, and they were always, for a long time, the three most Republican counties in Wisconsin.
And the races were which side could turn out more of their voters, Republicans in WOW counties, Democrats in Milwaukee and Dane counties. Everybody else's votes mattered and might swing it one way or the other, but the turnouts in those kind of counties, they really could swing races, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the turnouts, the size of the margins, I mean, there are purple counties in Wisconsin, there are swing areas of Wisconsin, but a big part of the dynamic in these elections was this kind of base versus base, you know, Milwaukee and Dane and the WOW counties in between.
Now, you note in a recent article some cracks appearing there. Not that these three counties are, you know, delivering massive margins in favor of Democrats, but something's changing. What is happening?
Yeah, I mean, it's been really striking to see many of these communities, after trending more and more Republican over the decades, suddenly kind of reverse direction and start getting less Republican. I mean, this is not surprising when you sort of, you know, from a national perspective, because a lot of suburban counties in major metropolitan areas around the country have gotten less Republican or gotten more Democratic in the last 10 or 15 years. The WOW counties had kind of resisted that national trend for a long time. And they were really pretty exceptional from a national perspective. But in the Trump election of 2016 and in the midterms in 2018, and even in the judicial races, the big statewide Supreme Court races of the last 3 years, we've seen definite signs that the WOW counties, in particular, two of the three WOW counties, Waukesha and Ozaukee, are not as red as they used to be.
Now, if I'm a Republican candidate or I'm a nonpartisan judge running with Republican support for the Supreme Court, I'm still probably going to win these counties. But can you talk about how much the margins have shifted?
Yeah, you're still going to win them. But, you know, here I'll give you a few examples. Scott Walker, in his last successful race for governor, won Waukesha County by almost 50 points. Donald Trump in 2016, won Waukesha County by 27 points. So he won it by a lot, but he won it by nowhere near as much as Republicans were used to winning Waukesha in Wisconsin. In the Supreme Court race we had this April, these races have kind of, they're nonpartisan, but as we all know, they've kind of become partisan in all but name. Quote, Republican candidate, the conservative candidate, won Waukesha County by 14 points. So that's, you know, 45 points, Scott Walker 2014, 14 points, Supreme Court race in 2020. And it's been even more dramatic in Ozaukee County. I mean, Waukesha is the big one, the most important one. Ozaukee's a lot smaller. And Ozaukee, you know, is also the most sort of upscale of these counties. And so you do see, you know, these trends, you see it being increasingly less Republican. Ozaukee in the 90s was the most Republican county in Wisconsin. You know, Donald Trump only carried Ozaukee County by less than 20 points. And it's really, some of the communities in Ozaukee County have gone from red to purple.
We're talking to Craig Gilbert from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about crucial counties in Wisconsin elections, ones that can tip Wisconsin. And of course, Wisconsin could tip the presidential race. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you live in one of the wow counties, Waukesha, Ozaukee, Washington, do you feel like things are changing politically there for better or worse, whichever way you view it? 800-642-1234 is the number. All right, Craig, why? Why is this happening?
So, again, I mentioned the national trend. I mean, there are big kind of structural patterns here at the national level where a lot of suburban communities where people tend to have higher rates of college education tend to be more socially moderate. And you have a situation where those kinds of voters have become less Republican over time. And we've seen these big trends like, you know, rural areas and blue collar voters getting more Republican in the Trump era and even before the Trump era, and suburban voters and college educated voters getting less Republican. And so you apply that to communities like this, which, like I said, had long resisted those trends for reasons we can talk about. So that's going on. You know, there's probably some degree of population shifts that are part of it. You know, there's a lot of staunch Republicans in these communities that remain staunch Republicans, but there's evidence to suggest that independent voters in these communities have gotten less, you know, are less likely to vote Republican. And there's also a big gender gap in the suburbs. I mean, Marquette's polling suggests that the gender gap is bigger in suburban communities than it is in rural or urban communities right now. And because of Donald Trump's weakness with female voters, I mean, that is hurting the Republican Party in the suburbs right now.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was going to ask your guest, how much do you think the change is due to an actual change in the core beliefs of the individuals in these counties? Or do you think it's just a revulsion against Donald Trump? Or are these people truly accepting the Bernie Sanders view of a party? Or are they is there really a role for a moderate that would be able to span to talk to both sides as opposed to the two extremes?
Charlie, thanks a lot. You packed a lot in there. First of all, the Trump effect, how much of this, as Charlie suggests, Craig, could be just because of Donald Trump?
Yeah, I mean, it's no coincidence that, you know, we saw this trend really begin in a big way in the 2016 election. I mean, the only counties in Wisconsin where Donald Trump did significantly worse than Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan had done 4 years earlier were Waukesha and Ozaukee counties. And so you do have a lot of voters in these counties who are, you know, kind of moderately conservative. Again, maybe moderately conservative on social issues. And they recoiled against Donald Trump's leadership style. One big illustration of that was if you go back to the Wisconsin presidential primary in 2016, that was Donald Trump's last big defeat in the race for the Republican nomination. And nowhere in Wisconsin did he do worse in the Republican primary than in what had been the most Republican part of the state, which is the Wow counties.
Thanks a lot for the call, Charlie. We're talking to Craig Gilbert right now, Washington Bureau Chief from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's with us to talk about the role that Wisconsin's Wow counties, Waukesha, Ozaukee, and Washington and southeastern Wisconsin have played in elections, how they can impact the 2020 election, some shifts going on there in voting. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you now or have ever lived in one of those counties, what are your thoughts on their impact on Wisconsin politics and elections? If you live there now, do you see a change going on? Do you have a question for Craig? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now we're picking up our conversation on the role the WOW counties play in elections here in the state, especially looking ahead to November. Craig Gilbert is with us, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you live in one of those WOW counties, Waukesha, Ozaukee, Washington, do you see a political change going on there? Still Republican support in general, but not as strongly as in the past. That's what some elections recently have shown. Join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Rose is with us in Menominee Falls. Rose, hello.
Hi there. I just was calling to say I've lived in Menominee Falls for 26 years. I am a Democrat. I have worked for Democrats every single year I've lived here. I can tell you there is definitely a change. We will never be a majority in this area, but if we can eat at the margins effectively, and my question to Craig Gilbert is, when Scott Walker lost his last election, I don't have the exact numbers right, but I'm pretty sure he always got 73% of the vote out of Waukesha County. And in this most recent election, when he lost, he only got 62%. Now, those numbers may not be totally accurate, but I believe they are close enough, and they do indicate a definite difference in the parties in Waukesha County.
Rose, thanks a lot for that call. That swing in Walker votes in the county there, Craig, between his successful election and then the recent one that he lost.
Yeah, I mean, no doubt about it. I think I mentioned his winning margin was something like 45 points in 2014, which puts him above 70%, as the caller noted. And it was significantly smaller in 2018. I'm looking at Menominee Falls, where the caller called from, and Donald Trump's winning margin in Menominee Falls was 10 points smaller than Mitt Romney's had been 4 years earlier, and Mitt Romney lost that election statewide. Scott Walker's winning margin was 13 points smaller in Menominee Falls in 2018 than it was in 2014. So these kinds of numbers, you know, add up. And, you know, this is a part of the state that had always been kind of the foundation of the, you know, really the path to victory, the foundation of Republican victories. Obviously, the rest of the state mattered greatly, but you sort of built a winning formula in Wisconsin if you're a Republican by, you know, really turning out your Republican vote in these counties. And then, you know, and then you went on and tried to do well in the Fox Valley and tried to compete in more purple parts of Wisconsin. But, you know, the remarkable thing is that Donald Trump still won statewide despite really underperforming in this part of the state that's so important to his party. That's the interesting question becomes whether he can do that again in 2020. It was almost like kind of filling an inside straight in 2016. It's going to be a challenge to do that again in 2020.
Thanks for that call. Chris joins us now from Milwaukee. Chris, hello.
Hi. You know, I've lived in Menominee Falls. I know Waukesha County, and I'll tell you, for a very long time, there were no Democrats running. So what was the point if you were a Democrat or lean Democratic to go out and vote? Recently, some people have put themselves out there and put out decent candidacies on the Democratic side. And while they haven't won, they have drawn out voters. And I think that percentage is changing. A big part of it is changing because there are more Democrats coming out, not necessarily less Republicans.
Thanks a lot for that call. Craig, our last two callers talking to the maybe strategy of the Democratic Party and the Democratic Party of Waukesha County, which exists, to try to chip away at that margin.
Well, I mean, Democrats have been paying a lot of lip service to Waukesha County, you know, over the past decade or more, because, as they rightly point out, it's big enough that I think it has the third highest number of Democrats in the state, even though it's a very Republican county. So what the caller was talking about does matter. What also matters is who's the Democratic candidate on the top of the ticket. And I think, you know, I think arguably Joe Biden is a more effective Democratic candidate in some of these communities than maybe a candidate, a Democrat to the left of Joe Biden would have been, because a lot of these voters are not necessarily the voters we're talking about that are persuadable are not necessarily, you know, out and out progressives, but they're more moderate voters. And especially they may even have conservative leanings on some issues. But if they're turned off by Donald Trump, you're going to need a candidate if you're a Democrat, if you want to peel them away, who doesn't alienate or scare them.
Thanks a lot for that call. We've talked a little bit about what Democrats are trying to do to erode this margin. What did you hear from Republicans who want to go back to the old days?
Well, I think Republicans are concerned about this trend. I don't know if I can sort of pinpoint the formula for kind of restoring their margins in these counties. I mean, part of the formula statewide is you know, making up their losses and their erosion here in other parts of the state, if they can do that. I think it's hard to do in a Trump election, just because we've seen this area has a history of being a challenging part of Wisconsin for Donald Trump. There are certainly, you can imagine certain kinds of Republicans that are better fits. I mean, on the other hand, you know, Scott Walker was a better fit for the WOW counties, but he wasn't immune to this trend in 2018. He did his drop off in these counties was much bigger in 2018 than it was statewide. So he wasn't able to sort of transcend the trends that we've been talking about.
And just our last few moments, Craig, we talked after the 2016 election about counties in southwestern Wisconsin that had some of the most extreme swings, smaller counties, but from Obama voters to Trump voters. Briefly, are you keeping a close eye on those?
Yeah, I'm keeping a, I mean, there are so many ingredients to Donald Trump's victory. One was, you know, the Obama-Trump communities, which are concentrated in western Wisconsin, communities that had voted for Obama and then voted for Trump. They're a big part of the dynamic. So are the communities, small Democratic cities. And we hear a lot about Milwaukee. There were lots of small Democratic cities around the state where Hillary Clinton badly, badly underperformed. And the question is, you know, if can Joe Biden do better in 2020 than Hillary Clinton did in those communities that have a long history of voting Democratic?
We'll leave it there and watch along with you, Craig. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Anytime.
Craig Gilbert is Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us today to talk about the role the WOW counties, Waukesha, Ozaukee, and Washington, will play in the upcoming 2020 election. Tribal communities in Wisconsin haven't seen a spike in COVID-19 cases like some in other parts of the country. But Native Americans are among the groups at higher risk for contracting the virus and complications that go along with it. As cases have surged around the state, tribes are remaining vigilant. Danielle Kading has more.
Here for COVID testing? I'm going to have you go right.
A man directs cars lining up for a drive-through testing event in Red Cliff. Larry and Alice Derrigan have been waiting in line for about an hour. The two are members of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, and they wanted to get tested just to be safe. He's 80, and she's 76 years old.
I have a heart problem, and I have high blood pressure, and I'm a diabetic. So she's healthier than I am.
I don't really have blood pressure or anything like that, but I've had a couple little problems with my heart, but nothing serious.
But they are serious about taking precautions, like doing daily temperature checks and wearing masks. They stick pretty close to home. Both are concerned because they know they're at higher risk, and coronavirus cases have grown since the state opened up. That's why testing is so important, according to Red Cliff Tribal Chairman Rick Peterson.
Testing is going to be a huge part of learning that, if anybody within the community has it, and then proper precautions can be taken to contain it.
A number of factors place Native Americans at higher risk for the virus, according to Jessica Atwell. She's an infectious disease epidemiologist with the Johns Hopkins Center for American Indian Health. Those include large families living under one roof or high rates of underlying health conditions.
So things like diabetes and heart disease. So when those conditions are present on top of the environmental factors, it can lead to increased risk.
In Wisconsin, Native Americans have higher rates of diabetes than the overall population. Joan Delabrew says diabetes is common on her reservation. She's the chairwoman for the governing body of the Menominee tribe. Health rankings show Menominee County, where her tribe is located, has the worst outcomes statewide. And Delabrew says the vast majority of their roughly 9,000 members are aging.
We can have one or two, sometimes three generations living in the same household. So you have a wide variance of ages, a high variance of risk factors, and they're all in the same household, so COVID could be very devastating.
The Menominee tribe worked with the Stockbridge-Muncie community and National Guard to conduct mass testing in May. Delabrew says that was key for their reopening plans because the tribe's clinic didn't have the capability to test that many people due to limited supplies from Indian Health Service. The federal agency's Bemidji area director, Daniel Fry, says tribal members in the region are being tested at a higher rate than the rest of the country.
Although there were some difficulties with testing at the forefront, we have multiple platforms to test now.
He points to rapid tests that have been provided to every tribe in Wisconsin and support from the state to conduct testing. Indian Health Service has also distributed around $31 million to the state's 11 tribes through the CARES Act and other coronavirus funding. Fry feels the agency's response has been adequate. But tribal advocates say the agency has been historically underfunded. Spending has increased in recent years, but the amount of money spent on care for individuals is less than other federal programs like Medicare and Medicaid. Atwell, the epidemiologist with Johns Hopkins, says there needs to be a better grasp of the longstanding racial and health disparities among tribal communities.
And resource limitations that put these at greater risk for pandemics like this one and have done so in the past and will do so in the future unless we can work together to address those underlying challenges.
Tribal health advocates are urging Congress to provide more funding to help tribes with coronavirus response in its next relief package. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, many therapists have had to take their work online. We'll hear about the challenges and some of the opportunities of teletherapy with two Wisconsin therapists. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Certain types of violent crime are rising this year compared to last year in cities across the nation, including Milwaukee and Madison. We'll look at what's driving the uptick and what local leaders are doing about it coming up. First, since the coronavirus pandemic reached the U.S., more people have needed to rely on virtual technology for a lot of things, work, personal connections, and for therapy. According to the American Psychological Association, three-quarters of clinicians are conducting all therapy appointments remotely. Two Wisconsin therapists join us now for a look at the challenges and maybe benefits of remote therapy or teletherapy. Rachel Zentner is a licensed professional counselor at Behavioral Health Clinic in Wausau. Rachel, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
And Susan McDonald Conroy is a licensed marriage and family therapist and certified sex therapist at Clarity Therapy Center in Onalaska. Susan, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob and Rachel. Thanks for having me.
Well, Rachel, let's start with you. How much teletherapy had you done before the pandemic, or was this a brand new thing for you?
This was not a brand new thing for me. I would say that probably only 10% of my practice was online prior to the COVID-19 pandemic hitting. So it was really limited. Maybe 1 to 2 clients per month were online at that time.
And have you had to make the switch to complete teletherapy, or at least for the first few months there?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. We went to fully online for probably March through May. We started a limited opening of our clinic for high-level need and particular types of therapies that needed to be in person, and also just definitely at the clinician's discretion. I would say at this point probably 75% of my practice is still online.
And Susan, what's your before and after when it comes to teletherapy?
Yeah, I had probably less experience than Rachel. I did have everything, all the systems and a HIPAA compliant platform in place, but used it only in cases of bad weather or when someone somewhere else in the state was looking for a sex therapist or something that they couldn't find in their area. So not a lot prior. And then as the pandemic unfolded, there was lots of talks with clients about this might be how it goes. Let's do some informed consent forms and documentation. And it was a pretty quick switch to all but two of my clients, and two of my clients I continue to see in person.
Now, Rachel, I think a lot of the expectation was, okay, you know, this is just going to be second rate. It's not going to work as well as in person. What have you found switching to a lot more teletherapy than you had done previously?
I think that's a really good point, Rob. And I think that was maybe the assumption for both the clients and for the clinicians. I was really hesitant that I might lose a lot of body language or that energy exchange between a therapist and a client through online therapy. I've been pleasantly surprised in that I get a lot of great interactions when working with people over, very much like Susan said, the HIPAA-compliant platforms have wonderful technology in terms of what I can see with people, how I can observe people. The technology has been wonderful. And I think, at least from my perspective, both the client side of things and for myself as a clinician, reports have been overwhelmingly positive.
And Susan, what have you found maybe after the initial learning curve?
I think for the clients, initial learning curve as well, some of them were reluctant, like, okay, well, we'll see how it goes. And then some of the comments that I've heard is, wow, this is a lot better than driving in. You know, when you have clients that are driving maybe an hour to see you, all of a sudden it becomes way more convenient for them.
We're talking to Susan McDonald-Conroy and Rachel Zentner. They're both therapists here in Wisconsin. They're telling us about their experiences switching over to teletherapy for all or most of their patients and how that's working out. Susan, actually, both of you work in areas that I assume serve a pretty wide area, maybe rural communities that don't have a lot of options where they are will come to Onalaska or Wausau for help. Susan, let's start with you. Do you see this being something that that people are going to switch to, maybe even, knock on wood, when we're back to normal?
Definitely. I don't think everyone, but I think for some people that genie's not going back in the bottle and they're liking it. They're liking the convenience of it. And I think they'll continue that. I think the caveat would be, first of all, will insurance continue to reimburse for that? Is one of the things, and regulations. Those are just the two things that happened really quickly that enabled clinicians and clients to connect online pretty quickly. And, you know, that's still unfolding where that's all going to go.
Interesting. And Rachel, I know in Wausau, you're probably a hub for a pretty wide area of people coming to seek help. Do you see some of your clients or maybe other people's clients saying, hey, yeah, I can, you know, I drive an hour and a half, 2 hours. I want to stick with doing this from home.
Yeah, I think you might be onto something there, Rob. And Susan makes some great points in terms of the challenges we face coming up as things change in terms of insurance coverages and state regulations. You know, the relationship people establish with a therapist is really important and worth, the continuity of that relationship is really worth fighting for in terms of keeping that relationship sacred. So I think it's important to advocate for yourself with your insurance companies. And if you, you know, if you talk with them and say, this is really important to me to keep seeing this therapist, we're doing good work and the relationship is important. However, the platform, you know, I think we're going to continue to be able to do this kind of work.
I want to talk about some of the pros and cons here. And I've read in national reporting therapists saying, upside, we get to see people in their own homes, in their own comfort zone. Downside, they're in their own homes with the other people who live in their homes around them. It makes it hard to have a private, confidential conversation. What have you seen, first of all, Susan, when it comes to ups and downsides doing this remotely?
Yeah, I see that primarily mothers with little ones or couples with little ones, it's harder to get away. And so a lot of sessions where a couple is cozy, against their headboard with maybe a video in the other room for their kids and hoping that they won't have any interruptions. And another thing, just because of the timing as everything unfolded, was the colleges closed down around the same time. So there were some empty nesters that were maybe meeting as couples or individuals that had all the privacy in the world. And then all of a sudden they've got young adults living with them again. So the privacy, I've had a lot of sessions that I'm guessing Rachel has too, where their clients in their car, and that's the most private place they can get.
Yeah, Rachel, what kind of opportunities and maybe obstacles have you run into?
Susan, you're 100% correct. I've seen more people's vehicles maybe than I've seen of their homes, because that is a place where people can get away, particularly for my teenagers and young adults. They don't want to be in the house where mom or dad can hear what they're talking about with their therapist, and that's great that they can get away and have that private time with me. I think the pros go back to what we had talked about earlier, which was convenience, as well as financially. You know, gas money, making sure vehicles are in good repair. None of that then has to be a financial burden or issue for my client. They can get their phone, get their Zoom app up on their phone, and they can do therapy. So that's and scheduling as well. So there isn't an issue around trying to find childcare or trying to find those types of things to arrange, because there's the convenience factor of doing the online therapy.
Susan, I'll ask both of you this, and of course you can't talk about individual cases of patients, but in general, this is a tough time. We've got this pandemic. People are worried about their health. They may be worried about or actually dealing with job loss or job cutbacks. Do you sense a greater need for the kind of services that are out there, given just this added level of stress that's out there?
Oh, yes. I think anxiety thrives on uncertainty, and that's all we have around us right now is uncertainty. And, you know, you talk about jobs. You know, there was a client without any identifying information that had to stop and pause therapy because not only my client, but another family member both lost their job within the same day. And so that affects the finances. It affects everything. So, yes, the anxiety thrives on uncertainty, and everyone's doing their best they can to manage that right now.
And Susan, as Rachel, actually, as we wrap up, can you talk about, you know, maybe the need for people to reach out and seek help where they might not have before in this tough time?
I think now more than ever, we need each other as humans. We are in an unprecedented time. We cannot ask a living person what it's like to go through a pandemic. They're not here. So we have to rely on each other. We have to talk about these things. We need to experience this together and be as open and vulnerable as we possibly can about what's actually going on for us. No one is alone in this thing that's happening, and there's no right or wrong answer. So I would encourage anyone that's listening, please reach out. We as professionals are absolutely here for you, and we'll try to meet your needs in whatever platform is easiest for you to access.
We'll leave it there. Rachel, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rob. This is so important. Thanks for doing this.
And Susan, thanks for being with us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Rob.
We've been talking to two Wisconsin therapists, Rachel Zentner of Wausau and Susan McDonald Conroy of Onalaska. They join us to talk about teletherapy during the pandemic. Coming up, we'll look at what's behind a surge in some kinds of violent crime in U.S. cities this summer. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to writers and activists about a new anthology out this month written by people with disabilities, marking 30 years since the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Now, Madison police say there's a, quote, alarming trend of gun violence in the city. In the second quarter of this year, the number of shots fired incidents was up by nearly 80% over the same period last year. And over the past couple of weeks, police say they've recovered about 150 shell casings. In Milwaukee, Mayor Tom Barrett said the number of homicides is on track to double last year's total. During a press conference heading into the July 4th weekend, he also said non-fatal shootings are up 50% over this time last year.
But we have to have our community groups, our religious groups, our police officers band together. We cannot accept this level of violence in this city. I do not accept this level of violence in this city.
Other U.S. cities are reporting an uptick in gun violence as well this summer. Richard Rosenfeld is a curator's Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Criminology and Criminal Justice at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. His areas of expertise include social sources of violent crime, crime control policy, and crime trends. Richard, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you co-authored a report that came out recently showing that homicides had been down in April and May during the pandemic. A gun violence, it looks like, is on its way up for June. Also homicides in some cities. Can you put these numbers in perspective for us?
Yeah, well, just a word on that study we did about a month ago. We did find that in April, across 64 large cities in the U.S., homicides were down considerably, comparing April of 2020 with the previous three-year average for that month. We also found a decline in May, but that decline was only half as large as the decline in April. We had to limit that study to the end of May. We're currently doing a follow-on study that will include the month of June. And my expectation, given the reports from cities around the country of increased levels of homicide and other serious violence, is that we're going to find an uptick in June.
How have homicide numbers gone over the last few years? I know looking at Milwaukee, yes, it's higher this year than last year substantially, but that had been after a few years of decline in Milwaukee. Are we shooting to new high levels around the state, or are we kind of regressing to a mean here?
That's hard to say. I would say, though, that it's probably not regression to a mean. What I would argue is that we're probably looking at elevated rates of homicide and gun violence generally that will rival those of 4 to 5 years ago in cities like Milwaukee, not sure about Madison, but other large cities across the United States. That uptick in homicide and other serious violence was associated with the social unrest that prevailed then in response to police violence in Ferguson, Missouri, in Baltimore, Chicago, New York, and elsewhere around the country. We're seeing, we have seen, of course, a sustained level of social unrest associated with or in response to police violence currently in Minneapolis and elsewhere. And it seems to me that we'll be looking at levels of serious violence that certainly will rival those of 4 to 5 years ago.
So would you make the case that the unrest, the protests of police violence are the cause? They're causing this increase in gun homicides.
Well, that's a tough
I know it's hard to tease out, yeah.
Yeah. You know, I have to say, as people in my business always say, that we shouldn't make too much out of a one-month increase. We have to wait and see whether this increase is sustained, how widespread it is. Given that, I do think that the social unrest is associated with higher levels of violence in our cities. Cause is a strong word, and it's certainly, it's very likely not the only contributing factor. As I mentioned, we saw a decline in homicide during the month of April and a somewhat smaller decline in May. That was during a period in which most cities were, in effect, locked down. Businesses were closed. People were, confined to their homes by and large. And as activity levels on the street subsided, homicide went down. Most homicides, with the notable exception of domestic homicide, most homicides occur outdoors. When outdoor activity subsides, homicide tends to go down. But the country has now reopened, or certainly begun to reopen in many places, although that may be, we may be some pulling back, seeing some pulling back from that. And the reopening is, I would argue, a contributor to the increased levels of violence. But I also think that the social unrest is. And I'm happy to talk about the ways in which social unrest might be connected to increased levels of violence.
Talking to Richard Rosenfeld from the University of Missouri, St. Louis, professor emeritus there of criminology and criminal justice. Yeah, how can you connect the dots there? Yeah. What kind of connections are there?
Well, there are at least two possible connections. One is that as the police have been deployed to address protest activity across the country, and keep in mind, we've witnessed the largest degree of social unrest in our country, at least since the Vietnam War. As they've been deployed to address protest activity, of course, they're taken off their normal patrol assignments, and that can contribute to an uptick in crime. There are some accounts, it's difficult to say, you know, how widespread this process would be, but there are some accounts that the police have withdrawn. That is, they're not as likely to engage in proactive policing of the sort that can reduce crime out of fear for legal liability, out of anger on the part of the police, frustration, exhaustion, and other reasons. But another connection, and I think this one is probably the most important, turns the former explanation on its head. And instead of asking or stating that the police are withdrawing from the community, this explanation suggests that under current conditions, the anger, frustration about police violence has caused some communities to withdraw from the police. Less likely to contact the police when a crime occurs, less likely to contact the police when oneself has been victimized, more likely, therefore, to take matters into their own hands when disputes arise, problems emerge, and that can contribute to crime. So those are the ways in which I think the protest activity can be connected to an uptick in violence. It's not a simple cause-effect relationship, and I don't think we know yet how important one of those mechanisms might be compared to the others.
Let's look at that second point and talk about a possible solution. If, in fact, you've got communities that have lost trust in police, that won't go to them, maybe for that small problem that develops into the big problem that leads to a homicide, how do you rebuild that?
You begin immediately, and you begin with the police, in my view. The police have to begin the long process, and it will be a long one, but extremely important, of repairing the relationship that between some communities, in particular communities of color, and the local police department. Now, what does that mean? That means the police have to fully engage with community members well beyond the periodic meetings that police officials will hold with community members. It means that police officers, while out on patrol, need to get out of their vehicles, say hello to people in the street, ask people in the street, in particular in neighborhoods where violence has gone up, what are the problems around here and how can we help you and how might you be able to assist us in dealing with them? That has to occur hourly, daily, week in, week out. And the police not only should be engaging with people on the street, they should be knocking on people's doors, especially in those communities hard hit by violence, and asking people, what can we do to help solve problems in this community? That's the way to do it. It's going to be a long slog, but I can't think of any other way, certainly no better way, to begin the long process of repairing police-community relations.
We'll leave it there. Richard, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Richard Rosenfeld, Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Criminology and Criminal Justice at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. We talked to him about an uptick in violent crime, especially gun violence in U.S. cities, including Milwaukee and Madison. You can share your thoughts, how to rebuild that trust between police departments and communities. What do you think needs to happen? You can email ideas@WPR.org, or as always, you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. There's a decent chance for rain in a lot of the state over the next couple of days, and that comes after a few days of no rain. So there's a good chance that a lot of us will get that smell, that it's just about to rain smell. You know, that smell. But what is that? The rain itself doesn't actually have a scent, and our noses can't smell into the future. Not yet, anyway. Producer Bill Martins found an article about this. It turns out it's not the rain, it's the bacteria. A few months back, I talked to a science writer about the smell of dirt, which is actually the smell that soil bacteria put out. That scent is called petrichor. Most of it comes from an organic compound called geosmin, which some kinds of bacteria produce in the soil. All right, that's dirt. So why the pre-rain smell? According to this piece, it's the same bacteria and some of the same chemicals that they produce. When weather is dry, though, they slow down and make a lot less of it. But when it's about to rain, the air suddenly gets more humid, usually, and these bacteria dudes kick into high gear and start cranking out some serious geosmin real fast. And our noses are able to detect even tiny amounts of this stuff and that petrichor smell. So, as the rain rolls in this week, stand outside, thank the bacteria, and wait for that smell, and maybe have an umbrella handy. Smell news you can use. This is Central Time.